From the Ghost Night Media Studios, welcome to the Paranormal Underground Presents podcast, where we explore the unexplained with our resident panel and our special guests.
Hey, it's Karen. We're doing something a little bit different today because we are going to be talking with Bill Robards, who is the host and one of the producers of the documentary that I'm also producing, Avalanche of Spirits, The Ghosts of Wellington. We're going to let Cheryl run the show, and I'm just going to be answering questions. So we have with us Cheryl and J.D. Harrison. Hey, guys.
Hey, Karen.
Hey, Karen. How you doing?
Hey, J.D.
Good. So am I in for a grilling, J.D.?
Kind of. Maybe mildly.
Okay, be nice to me.
I'm always nice to you.
I know where you live.
I know. Okay.
Okay, cool. Well, let's go ahead and get started then. On the line with us, we have my good friend and the host of the documentary Avalanche of Spirits, The Ghosts of Wellington, Bill Robards. Hey, Bill.
Hi, Karen. Hello, everybody.
Hey, Bill.
Hey, Bill.
How you doing?
I'm doing pretty good. How are you?
Good, thanks.
Good.
Okay, well, Cheryl, I can't believe I'm doing this, but I'm giving up control. It's all yours.
Ooh, yay. What shall I do now? Just kidding. Well, I wanted to start off by reading something off of the website avalancheofspirits.com. And you can get there by going to www.avalancheofspirits.com, of course. Basically, this paragraph is about the project, the documentary that Karen is directing and producing and Bill is hosting. And they're working with a great group of people on this documentary. But here's a little blurb about the project. This film tells a story of the growing desperation of passengers and employees aboard two Great Northern Railroad trains that were stuck in a tiny railroad town of Wellington, Washington, during a nine-day snowstorm that battered Stevens Pass in late February of 1910. The passengers and employees were trapped on an avalanche-prone mountainside by the weather and desperate to find their way home. A century after the avalanche that killed them all, not much has changed. Many passengers remain trapped at Wellington, unable to make it home. And this is their story. So that's a little bit about the documentary. I wanted to start with Karen and ask, why Wellington?
The first thing that I want to tell you is that it says two trains in what you just read. Some research has uncovered that there's a possibility that there were three trains.
Okay.
But two were actually freight trains, you know, the mail train and some other kind of freight train. And then the other thing is that there were several rotary trains that also went down the mountain. And what those are trains that chunk through the snow. So there was a lot of stuff that went into this river valley. Why Wellington? I went to Wellington on July 11th for the first time. Bill went with us, as a matter of fact. And we were just sort of scouting locations because we were planning on working on a completely different documentary project. And
okay.
Reagan, at a part of Washington, invited us to meet her up at Wellington, and we did. Boy, it's an interesting place. I didn't, you know how I've been. I've been very agnostic about belief in ghosts.
Yeah.
And as a matter of fact, as I've been listening, I've been listening back to some of the podcasts that we've done recently. And
okay.
Boy, I was really agnostic, and all of a sudden, I'm a believer, and I'm a believer in ghosts because of Wellington. Wellington has a great story. It's a beautiful place, and there's something going on there.
Okay. Can you tell us a little bit more about the team that's filming the documentary with you?
I approached Karen months ago through a mutual friend of ours. Our goal initially was to do 10 documentary-style movies, maybe 90 minutes or so, on the 10 most haunted locations in Washington. Through a mutual friend, they said, you got to get a hold of Karen Frazier. So the first time we spoke, Karen and I figured out 10 locations probably within 5 minutes. That would be
okay.
Great to investigate. So from there, Karen had already known Reagan and Vinny and introduced me to them. And so when we did go up to Wellington on the 11th of July, we ran into Bert and Jamie Coates from Northwest Paranormal Investigation Agency, who I can't imagine anybody on the planet knowing any more about Wellington than these two. And I knew immediately they had to be a part of what we're trying to accomplish. Not only is it for me, because I'm not an investigator, it's it's a chance for me to not only tell the story that really a lot of people don't know about, and it's kind of right in our backyard, but, you know, to find out if it really is haunted. My goal was to put together the best team possible and have diverse investigative teams to check it out and see what happens, and I'm just the spectator.
And one of the things that I like about having Bill work on the project with us is that he's a former Marine, and he's afraid of ghosts.
Yeah, it's everybody finds it pretty funny, actually.
Sorry, Bill.
Have you had any past experiences with the paranormal, Bill?
I think I have. I definitely am a believer my whole life, actually, and my parents are believers, and I think that there's been some unexplainable things that have happened in the house I live in now or almost anywhere I've ever lived. What's scary to me is I've been all over the world and worked with many different foreign militaries and got to see a little combat, but that didn't bother me as much as things that I can't explain. You know, if you hear or see something that, and you don't recognize it immediately, then I guess that's the humor in it for me.
So getting back to the team for a minute, we have Reagan and Vinny Vocknitz of a part of Washington. We have Bert and Jamie Coates of Northwest Paranormal Investigation Agency. And then we have Stephen Johnston, who is with a part of Washington. And he's also a film student, so he's been just absolutely invaluable. Also on the team is my husband, Jim, who, as you know, was a big skeptic, and he's not so much anymore either. So.
Would you say that Jim is a believer now after experiencing Wellington?
I can't speak for him here. I can relate the conversation that we had the last time we were driving back from Wellington. I said to him, so do you believe that there are ghosts at Wellington? And he said, yeah, I think there's definitely something going on there. So for me, that's pretty major.
Right. What kind of hauntings or paranormal activity have been said to take place there at Wellington?
Personal experience, I can tell you that when you first walk into the snow shed, and what Wellington is it's a hiking trail. It's the Iron Goat hiking trail in the Cascade Mountains of Washington State. It's a rails to trails project, and it's the former railroad grade. So there's a lot of big snow sheds that they built after the avalanche disaster at Wellington to protect the trains. So when you walk into the snow shed, I would say that there's a feeling. What do you think, Bill?
Well, for me, I've been up there twice, but for me, I think I can't explain it other than my surroundings when I'm around the snow shed. Not talking about the parking lot or not talking about the actual wreckage site, which is 200 feet below the snow shed, but the air and everything feels so heavy around me just when I'm in that area. You know, I haven't necessarily really seen anything, or I don't know that I've experienced anything, but I definitely get a weird feeling when I'm up there.
Right, and it's more than a feeling. There are shadow figures I've seen, and a lot of other people. I've heard a lot of stories. There are both the black shadow features and this little sort of white flitting thing that you see. There's a lot of noises. You'll hear disembodied voices, and you get a lot of EVPs.
Now, I know that you said that you actually had some physical encounters with something unseen, such as like hair pulling, a push, you know, a brush on the arm, something like that where it can't be accounted for.
Yeah. There's so much that happens up there that I absolutely forgot about all of that stuff. Yes, that happens too. There's one thing that happens that a lot of people describe, including my kids, that you'll feel something on the bottom half of your legs, maybe a little above knee height. And it feels like a child running and brushing past you. And that's a very common experience up there. Bill has had some physical experiences up there, too.
I have. I'm trying to my brain focused on the scariness again.
I know. It seems so much less scary when you're not there.
It does. Physical. Oh, that's right. The first time we were up there.
Yeah.
When you walk down the snow shed, it's the size of the structure is so massive and overwhelming anyway, and it's old, and it kind of gives it that creepy feeling. But The first time we were up there, we were just walking down through there. It was during the day, and there was at least a 10-foot section of the snow shed, to me, that felt like it was 20 or 30 degrees colder than anything else. The wind wasn't blowing. It wasn't any, and I was the only one that felt it. We were all kind of walking together, and it just, I was freezing to death just for about 10 feet. I'd asked everybody if they felt a chill, but in this section that I was freezing to death, my whole body itched like I was allergic to something, or it was absolutely crazy, and I was the only one that had experienced it. We were all standing together.
And when you think about, you know, Bill's history with the Marine Corps and everything else, this is a guy who's trained to not be affected by his environment, to not be nervous about things. So when you watch somebody like Bill, who, what I know of him and his history, something like that happen, you sort of have to start to wonder a little bit.
Definitely.
That was pretty bizarre.
Yeah. Well, Karen, you brought up something interesting about a breeze that, not even a breeze, but the feeling of maybe children running past and brushing up, you know, against you. And I know that on the website, avalancheofspirits.com, you have a picture that's actually representative of something in a video that was captured by NWPIA, by Bert and Jamie. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, that's actually a really great capture. It's on their website, www.nwpia.com. And you can go and you can click on, I think, Wellington or their evidence or something, and it's there. They were just fiddling with their camera, trying to get their camera to do something. And on review of evidence, what they saw was this little white body sort of peek out from behind a pole. And they also have a video where they audio captured a child saying mama, and it was a disembodied voice because they all heard it at the same time. Now, realize that this is in the mountains in October. It's far from anything. You have to drive down a country road probably 10, 15 minutes to even get into Wellington. The nearest road is the freeway that runs Highway 2, and you do get a lot of noise from Highway 2, but at night, at midnight, 2 o'clock in the morning, there's not much. The fact that they had no children with them and they hear this little child and they get it on a video saying mama, I think is fairly significant.
And how many people were actually killed in that avalanche at Wellington, and how many of those people were children?
The true answer is that nobody knows how many people were killed. So research has shown that it's anywhere between 96 and 120. Have you seen figures bigger than that, Bill, or is 120 your top end that you've seen?
Well, the one report I saw is the most I saw was 118.
Okay.
The reason that they don't know exactly how many were killed is there's a river at the bottom of the wreckage site. When the river started to thaw, that kind of washed a lot of debris and people away with it that were never found. There's been people that have never been found.
Plus, not only that, but they had a large number of immigrant laborers working, and several walked off the job. Well, they have no idea how many walked off the job, how many remained, how many were killed. So they really tried to downplay the number that were killed. Getting to the children, let me see if I can reconstruct this. There was a 3-year-old girl, and her name was Thelma. And she was actually cut in half. They found her cut in half, half of her body hanging from a wire and half of her body somewhere else. There was the entire Beck family, which had 3 children, Irma, Leonard, and the other one's name escapes me right now. I'm sorry. It's on our website. It's marked as their children. There was an entire family that escaped being killed with their children. And then there was a family where half of the family was wiped out and half of them lived. And that was the Starrett family, S-T-A-R-R-E-T-T, I believe. And they had 2 children who lived and 2 children who died, I think.
Harriet Beck was the other child's name.
What was it?
Harriet Beck.
Harriet, thank you. And the Starrett kids were Lillian and Francis, maybe? I'm sorry. I have all the names swimming in my head.
The reason why I ask about how many children there were is you had written an article in the September issue of Paranormal Underground magazine about your experience up at Wellington and the different things that you had happen. Well, something that happened actually wasn't contained to the site of Wellington, and it actually followed you home. Can you tell us about that a little bit?
Yeah, that's true. It did. When we were going home in the van with Bill, we were staying on Whidbey Island, and so Bill was driving. And Bill and Jim were up front, sort of oblivious, just talking guy stuff, probably trying to stay awake because it was fairly late. And the whole time I was in the van, I had this feeling that it's very hard to explain. It was a feeling on the, a physical feeling almost. And I knew that someone was there with me. There was a train that was coming down out of the mountains, and we were sort of going with us across the flats as we came out of the mountains. And I could feel whatever this was really excited about this train. So finally, I just sort of said, you can't come with me. You need to go back. Well, at this point, I had, other than having the sense it was a child, I had no way of knowing that. Well, I talked to Reagan the next day, and they had something also get in the car with them and follow them about the time that I told it to get out. Now, I don't know, Bill, you and Jim didn't have any idea that I thought there was something in the car, did you? Or did you have any sense of it?
No, not at all.
Yeah. And then we got back to the hotel on Whidbey Island, and I felt like it was there again for a little while. And then later, about a week later, I'd say, I was at home, and I heard something in my entryway, and I went out, and something that was on the stairs had been moved and was sitting in the middle of the floor, and the dogs were freaking out. So I looked out the door to see if maybe there was somebody outside or if it was really windy or something, because my screen door was closed, but my front door was open, and I heard a little voice behind me say hi.
Okay. Interesting.
and we have several EVPs that sound like a kid.
And you had actually, I don't know if you call it a vision, but some kind of thoughts about the child being a 3-year-old, and you had a vision of what they look like.
Yeah.
And then you researched it and actually came to some interesting findings.
Yeah. At the time, I hadn't read the book about Wellington yet, because we just went up there sort of to see what it was all about. But I ordered the book, and I had it. And I looked through it, and I found that there was one little boy, one of the Beck children named Leonard, who was 3 years old. And also the sort of the image I had in my mind of the clothes they wore and stuff, that was what they wore in 1910.
Yeah, interesting.
Yeah.
Very much so.
Yeah.
So I wanted to ask you and Bill, when do you plan on finishing the project and making it available for everyone?
Actually, tomorrow we hope to wrap up the filming that we need to do. Now, what my goal, and I think we are all in agreement, that our vision is not only just see if we can capture some paranormal activity, but to tell the story, explain the history of actually what happened. I'm not from Washington, and I never had really even heard the story until, you know, I talked to Karen, and we actually went up there.
Okay.
So we need to finish filming the footage that we want to put into this project. And then there's a lot of narration work and studio time and a lot of editing. So when you get into post-production, then the work really begins. So
right.
I think our goal is to have it completed by the first of the year, but our release date, it will be on the 100-year anniversary of this disaster, which is March 1st.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
And we'd also like to, we're sort of in the process of planning a commemoration to go kind of hand in hand with the release as well, because we feel that it's important to recognize what happened there.
Great. Well, I know that JD has some good questions for you, so I want to go ahead and turn it over to JD.
Hi, thanks, Cheryl.
Sure.
Cheryl, you still there?
Yes.
I have a question for you since we're in charge tonight. What happens if I touch this button right here?
Don't do it. Don't do it.
All right. Bill and Karen, these questions are kind of for both of you. First of all, let me start with Karen, okay? Karen, I've come to know you very well. I respected your opinions, and I still do. Don't get me wrong. And I know for a long time you've been neither believer nor disbeliever. And the fact that this experience has changed you and your points of views about hauntings and the paranormal and things and basically swayed you into a believer has intrigued me, because I know you're not one to go off on a whimsy and to just take things under assumption. You like to think things out, and you'll question these things. And for you to do that, something had to really happen to impress upon you to make you change that way. And that's my first question. I know you've told Cheryl what you've seen and things like that, but I want to know, what has done it? What were the feelings that you have? Describe your feelings, your emotions, that type of thing at Wellington that actually converted you to being a believer.
First, let me say that I don't think I'm a blanket believer. I think that I believe on a case-by-case basis. How's that?
Yeah, I understand that. Okay. It's site-specific.
Yeah. Right, it's site-specific. So I believe that something's going on at Wellington. Okay. So we'll start from that point. I can't say anything about any other place because I haven't had experiences that have made me believe that. But at Wellington, I have. The first thing is, of course, what I was telling Cheryl about this little spirit, especially when I get home and I have EVPs of a child's voice interacting with my children and interacting with Reagan's son, Bobby. So mm-hmm. I think that those were really interesting pieces of evidence, especially when they were collected without the presence of walkie-talkies and with no cell phones turned on and there's no wires. It's the wild. You're out in the wild.
Right.
So that's been fairly impressive to me. There are things that have happened where Reagan or Vinny have had a sense of something, and then I get that same sense, but we get it separately from one another. And to me, that's fairly convincing because I've never really seen myself as somebody who has any kind of connection to anything as far as from an intuitive standpoint. So that's interesting to note for me. And then I've heard voices. I saw the last time we were up filming, I saw my first shadow figure. I mean, like, really saw it. I've seen things flitting in and out, you know, and I get that it's a big structure and that your eyes can play tricks. So I get that it's this sort of large, very dark concrete structure. I get that nature makes sounds. I get that sound travels in the dark, but it's just, there's a feeling there, and I've had enough evidentiary things to back it up that okay. My fervent hope is that when we're there tomorrow, that Bill has some experience that absolutely convinces him. He's had a few that have made him really wonder, but I'm waiting for the big one that will convince him that
okay,
there's something going on.
Yeah, I know that when I talked to you, it might have been a month ago or so, you had described to me that you were sitting on a bench. And do you remember that?
The poking?
Yeah. And yeah. You were being,
okay, being you poked. Wanna,
yeah, elaborate on that a little bit, because when you told me, I was, and you know me, we have conversations a lot, you know, tied into the magazine and things like that, what's going on, but I was fascinated. I mean, really, it blew me away to hear you talk like that, and I mean, I believed you, and just because, like I said, I know you, and I know you're not one to lightly take things like that and just make assumptions. You don't do
right,
that.
That's right. Well, and that's one of the things that's fairly convincing, too, is that I did, that was when we were up on July 11th as well, is I was sitting on a bench, Reagan was sitting on a bench across from me, and something was poking me. And I think, Bill, weren't you sitting there when I kept turning around and saying, there's something poking me?
Yeah, I was standing there on the lookout, right?
Well, and then what's funny about that is I said, well, why don't you go ahead and poke Bill? And on this recorder, you hear Bill go, ha, 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 that's just a great idea. And whatever is there, you hear this whisper go, no.
Oh,
ooh,
no.
Freaky.
All right. That's cool. That's really interesting. You just mentioned the concrete structure. We talk about that a lot. And Bill and Karen, both of you answer this. I've noticed in the photos that I could pull up and see that it appears to be massive, and I would assume it would be a job is to block an avalanche. So it's going to be big. But being in the mountains there and that type of thing, have you ever looked into what types of mineral deposits are in association with this? I mean, are there rock structures nearby, like in the side of the hill, that type of thing, you know, quartzes, granites? And I know, you know, with concrete, especially that much, it's going to contain a fair amount of quartz. And, you know, one of the theories is with paranormal activity and things, quartz and other types of minerals like that supposedly can amplify these activities. And I'm wondering if you ever looked at that or taken that into consideration, or if you've taken readings, and does that sort of correlate to that? You know, if you want to elaborate, either one of you.
Is that granite, Bill? Do you remember what it was?
Oh, it's not. No.
Well, I mean, the stuff that they blasted out of the tunnel, I think it's granite.
You know, I'm not really that familiar. Bert is the absolute expert on it. But what, to me, what is more out of place than anything is you see this huge concrete, you know, structure, man-made structure, and it's embedded deep into the woods. You know, there's mm-hmm. there's nothing around it. You know, there's not like it's the rock quarries right. and you know, rock mines around it. This was man-made, and it was there to protect trains from the weather.
Okay.
Other than that, I'm not really familiar. You know, like I said, I'm not familiar with investigation or activity or that kind of thing, so I don't know what can attract
okay.
ghosts or spirits or abnormalities.
Yeah, well, they're really... They blasted a 2.5 mile long tunnel out of the mountains.
That's a lot of rock.
Yeah, and I think it's granite is what I've heard or been told or observed or, you know, something. So there's lots of the rock that was blasted out sort of laying around. Now, the snow shed itself is actually probably about 1/4 mile away from the tunnel. Maybe longer, like maybe 1/2 mile altogether. And the snow shed itself is 1/2 mile long. It's huge.
Mm-hmm.
And it's well constructed, and it's all made of concrete. There's no electricity. The nearest electricity is up at the ski area, and that's probably a good 1-2 miles, something like that away. That's the okay. nearest electricity. And I hadn't thought about the mineral deposits or the quartz or the granite being possibly a source for that. But yeah, there could, because I do believe that the nature of some of what goes on there is residual.
Mm-hmm.
I mm-hmm. also think that some is active, but so I hadn't looked into that, but that's a really interesting thought.
Okay. I noticed in my research, and I looked into this historically. Now, you mentioned there was a possibility of more than two trains. This question is basically going on the assumption that there were two, because that's what base that I could come up with back then. They were talking about two trains, a passenger train and the mail train. And of course, the rotary engines that were there to clear the tracks and that type of thing. But when the avalanche hit these trains and it pushed them, I believe they said it was 150 feet or so down into the river valley. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
Has anybody... Have you conducted any investigations or anything in that valley?
Bill has. Bill's been
okay.
down there.
I have been down to the record site. Yes, I have.
Okay. And, would you tell me about that?
The access down there, I mean, the terrain's really steep. Mm-hmm. So from the snow shed to the final resting place of the debris, you know, 200 feet down, that's probably at a 75-80 degree angle. What's amazing to me and fascinating is how much debris is actually still there. Of course, they couldn't get everything out of there.
Right.
But 100 years later, that there is from snow and avalanche and people, and there's debris everywhere wrapped around trees. There's still huge, enormous hunks of unrecognizable metal laying everywhere. What would be interesting to me is that one of the trains was a mail train, and apparently at that time they only recovered one canvas bag of mail. Who knows how much that train carried, but if any of it 100 years later had ever survived, wow, what a treasure to find.
Yeah,
I was
thinking that, but...
but at the same time, I don't think that I would really want to disturb any of the debris necessarily, you know. What's interesting for me is that we got to think that this was 100 years ago. So when this happened, for rescuers to even get to the site is phenomenal what they had to deal with. I mean, it's not like they could hop on a helicopter and or hop on a snowmobile and get up there. I mean, it's pretty amazing.
Remote.
Yeah, and how many people did survive.
Have you conducted any of your investigations in that valley, and have you noted any paranormal activity down there? And if you have, is it similar to what you're experiencing up on the former track bed?
Bert and Jamie have. We haven't done any investigation down there just because there's a lot of big cats in the area, and to investigate down there, especially after dark, which is when things start to get active there, is after dark, because this happened at 1:40 in the morning.
Right.
And the activity usually starts about 9:30. Well, right now it's dark, and the team from Northwest PIA was down there, and they have actually video of a cougar dropping in on them while they were sitting down there trying to conduct an investigation. So we have to sort of keep our own safety in mind, too, and we go up,
right.
We go up armed. Mm-hmm. And we're very careful, but being in the valley during the daytime is one thing, but being down there at night just doesn't
right.
seem like a real good idea right now.
Well, that's understandable. Yeah, you don't want to risk your safety, especially in a debris field. You've got a lot of hidden things, and you wouldn't be able to see. But I was just curious if, you know, you were noting any paranormal activity down there or not, and if it was just as intense.
I will tell you that Vinny, who is a psychic, says that he thinks that down at the debris field, it's more residual.
He did say that, right.
Yeah, up above it's more active and down below. Because up above is where the town was. So there was a town there, there were people there, all of this stuff happened there.
Mm-hmm.
And there were more deaths than just this avalanche. It could be that the ghosts that are up there have nothing to do with the avalanche.
Okay.
Right.
All right.
I can tell you, though, that during the day, just kind of looking around the area, not investigating it necessarily, but when I said around the snow shed, I get a really heavy feeling. The air just feels heavy. It's a tense mm-hmm. feeling. When I was mm-hmm. down in the debris field, I was amazed, but I felt really comfortable and really calm, which was not how I felt in the snow shed itself. I don't know. That was just it was a different feeling for me. I was put at ease. I was fascinated by what I was seeing. When you're up in the snow shed, mm-hmm. it just seems a lot more tense.
I see. Yeah, that could be significant. You know, it could be some type of correlation, top and bottom, the difference. That's why I was curious about it. What I'd like you guys to do now is to elaborate on that, what you just said. Now, Karen, you had just mentioned that the hauntings or the activity seems to be more active at night. You do get activity in the day, though. Is that correct?
Absolutely.
Okay. Now, I'd like you to elaborate on what the difference is between the activity at day and night, and also what you're talking about, Bill, with your feeling inside of that snow shed. I want you to elaborate on that, especially, you know, you're talking about the heavy feeling and things like that. And what types of things are you seeing there?
Well, keep in mind that it's not active 100% of the time there.
Right.
So,
I wouldn't expect any
yeah.
place like that, you know.
So I have gone up and walked through that snow shed and not felt a thing. It's felt pretty. It's felt light. It just feels like you're in a gorgeous place. And I think probably that's been Bill's experience too. Have you been there, Bill, when you haven't really felt anything? It just feels like a snow shed?
Honestly, no. It's always felt really heavy to me.
Never feels like a snow shed to you, huh?
But the intensity of it is just can be heightened at different times, I guess. But I don't know. There's always an uneasy feeling in the snow shed for me, always.
Mm-hmm. You know what we need to do, Bill? We should hike down to the next snow shed. Wouldn't that be interesting?
That'd be great.
Yeah, we need to do that because I just want to see how, use you as a barometer and see if the next snow shed down feels the same way to you.
Right.
You know, like maybe it's just the structure or something. What were you asking, JD? I'm sorry. What was your question about the day, the difference in the day and the night? Is that what
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Give me like a little thing on a description on what your
sure.
difference between
sure.
day and night and
okay.
the feeling
Absolutely. Well, I'll give you an example in answer to your question. Well, first of all, you see more things at night. The black shadow figures and the figure that they call No Face come out. And No Face is a full-on apparition that doesn't have a face, but it has the clothing and the railroad clothing and the body and stuff. You hear a lot more disembodied voices at night, but during the day, you can still get a lot of EVPs, and you sort of feel, you can feel touches and brushes and that type of thing. Anyway, so I'll give you an example of the difference between day and night. There is an area down there that is referred to as Area 61. The reason it's referred to as Area 61 is because there's a big, huge 61 painted on the pole of the snow shed.
Okay, well.
So, the first time we went to Area 61 and started walking down, it was in the evening, and I almost puked. Because I felt so anxious. I was just all of a sudden terrified for absolutely no reason. And it's this long bridge that you walk across under the snow shed. It's not really a bridge. It's like two railroad tie boards with concrete in the middle. So when you walk across this, I feel anxious all the way across. But I can get across it. And sometimes I walk down there and I walk across it during the day and I feel just fine and there's no problem. I have been unable to get myself to go more than about two steps on that Area 61 bridge at night.
Hmm. And that's because?
I don't know.
Huh.
I don't know. Bill, why do I say I don't like to do it? I'm going to do it tomorrow, by the way.
I don't know why. I mean, you really feel something different than I feel. You definitely think that something's there. Or, you know, you are definitely uneasy about going any further.
Well, and that's where Steven zoned out, too, Bill.
He did zone out, yeah.
Yeah, one of the investigators that was down there with us was talking and walking normally, and all of a sudden, he was gone.
Have you conducted any EMF readings in there?
Mm-hmm.
And are they higher than normal, do you think, or...
They spike up and down. There is a zero baseline EMF reading all through the snow shed when there's no activity going on.
Okay.
But the EMF meter spikes up and down in certain places, and those places do correlate with where people have experiences and activity.
All right. Okay, I see.
And I use a Tri-Field Natural to do that, too.
Okay. All right. So... basically, it seems, what you're saying, it seems to be more oppressive at night, more of an intense feeling, so to speak, of maybe presence. Is that?
Well, I'll have Bill tell you about, because the first time that we went, we walked down in the daytime and we walked down in the night, and it was very different for him, too.
Okay.
But one of the things, and I can tell you that through my training with the Marine Corps, that this is where it would be relevant, is that when it's nighttime, and I don't know if everybody's experienced this, but when you've been in an area at night and the moon's not out, or you know it's really, really pitch black dark, your senses are heightened, you know, 1,000-fold. So your hearing and your sight and your smell, you know, activate immediately. So you're definitely more aware of your surroundings, which, you know, kind of raises the blood pressure anyway. So for me during the day, it's still a little interesting at times, but at night definitely it's definitely a heavier feeling. And the deal with it being outside rather than an actual structure that you're investigating or checking out is that you can't control your environment as far as like wildlife. You know, there's bears, there's cougars, there's snakes, there's rabbits, there's whatever. You know, they don't care if you're there. So you hear a lot of noises or you can see a lot of things that probably can be explained, but when it's pitch black out, you know, it's kind of a different situation. But say we were investigating a house or a funeral home or something like that, you can, in a sense, control your surroundings as far as noise, you know. You know what I mean?
Right.
Yeah.
But out there, you can't. So like the last time we were up there at night, there was just a small group of us that we were walking down the snow shed, and I was lagging behind. I was just kind of watching the investigators do their thing because, you know, I was a little spooked because I don't do this. But anyway, I kept turning around just to make sure there weren't any animals following us or whatnot, and there were twice, kind of peeked around the corner. There were, and it's pitch black, mind you, there were, you know, a pair of orange eyes, maybe knee-high off the ground, and probably, I don't know, 30 to 50 feet behind us, but it happened twice. But the interesting thing is, here's a pair of glowing eyes, but we didn't have any flashlights on or anything. You know how you shine something in somebody's eyes and then you can see them glowing?
Yeah.
Here it is, pitch black. It's pitch black with no light on whatever it was, and there's, you know, a pair of eyes there.
We did have IR lights.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, but you guys were traveling away from me.
Yeah, well, and the other thing about the snow shed at night is, I'll tell you this, JD, is that the last time we were there, we walked down when Bill was seeing the eyes and we were hearing things in the bushes and we were hearing things and I was seeing shadows and everyone else was seeing the same shadows that I was. And so we walked down in the dark, and this is when Steven zoned out. And we sort of felt like we were surrounded by entities there because we could see and hear and sense them in different areas all around us.
Mm-hmm.
Well, so then we walked back and we sat down for a while, mainly because I was too chicken to go across the Area 61 bridge. I'm going to do it. I'm doing it tomorrow night. So anyway, then we sat maybe for about a half an hour, and then Vinny and Steven and Jim walked back down, and they came up and they said, there's nothing going on in there. It's absolutely there. It feels like a different place. So they took me down with them. I walked down. I walked on that bridge. I felt nothing. Absolutely nothing. Walked back. We sat for a little while longer, and everybody else felt nothing at the same time. And then we started hearing voices in the snow shed again.
Hmm.
Right. Which Bert, shortly after you guys came back, and you said, yeah, there's nothing going on. Everything's okay. Bert was off by himself, and Bert came back, and he came up to me. I don't. You may have heard this too, Karen, but he said, I hear a woman either singing or screaming. It's very faint, but I hear a woman singing or screaming way down at the end of the shed. You know, he specifically heard that. And then that's kind of when we split up again, and, we all probably believe we were being followed by, or there was definitely some cougars around us. But he's an investigator who's been up there more than anybody who, so it's interesting for me to see the, you know,
yeah,
the thing.
Yeah. Well,
creeps me out a little more.
Yeah, but you still need to see or hear something, Bill.
Yeah, well, I did last time. I got freaked out for about 20 seconds. I heard something in the bushes, which could have been an animal, but as soon as I heard it, every hair on my body was, you know, doing 800 miles an hour trying to get out. And
yeah.
So for about 10, 20 seconds, I was frozen. And then, wow. Steve, you know, watching Steven, he was in a pretty deep trance. You know, somebody will just kind of drift off into space and daydream. That's kind of what he was like, although he really was not with us.
He was being jerked around like a puppet, Bill.
Yeah.
Do you remember that? That was so weird.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, that's interesting.
Yeah.
I don't really have any more questions for you, but I'd just like to say that I'm really looking forward to the documentary, and I can't wait till that comes out. I want to see it, and hopefully I can make it up there soon. And
Well, we're fighting the weather, JD, so it needs to be pretty soon. We have until November, probably mid-November.
Right, and then it'll be snowed in, I'm sure.
That's right, snowed in and avalanche prone. There's a reason that you don't go up there in the winter.
Right. No thanks right. for that. You know. Okay.
Well, not only the paranormal aspect of things, but I think we're all in agreement that we just need to put out the best possible story we can to explain exactly what happened and explain why there could be paranormal activity up there. You don't just pick a random spot in the Cascade Mountains and say, "Hey, this place is haunted."
Right.
There's a
right.
reason why there's activity there, and we're here to explain that. You know, and give the story justice that it deserves.
Well. Yeah, and it's actually historically, it's an amazing story as well. It's honest to God, when you read the story or when you hear the story and you realize everything that went up there, it's like nature was trying to make an example of these poor people on the train. Anything and everything that could have gone wrong did. And so we're telling that story. And the story that we're not telling is just as important of a part. And that's that the Cascade Tunnel is this 2.5 mile long tunnel that's no longer there. I mean, it's there, but it's no longer used. Well, back when the railroad was in its heyday going through there, hundreds of people asphyxiated in that tunnel because when they were going through on trains.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's part of the story that we're not even really telling. So, and then there's the story of the town of Wellington, which remained there for a number of years after this avalanche. And tragedies occurred in this town and houses burned down and that type of thing as well.
Hmm.
Yeah.
So it's actually a rich, as far as paranormal goes, it's a very rich area in history.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So. And one of the things that happens up there that I forgot to mention is, and I haven't experienced this and I would like to, is that most nights they start to hear the sound of a party. They hear music and they hear people talking and that type of thing. So I'm hoping that we experience that. I'd like to get that on film. That'd be awesome.
Cool.
Yeah.
Hey, well, Cheryl, I don't have any more.
Okay, thanks, JD. I just have a couple of follow-up questions, and one is regarding your tech team. I know the size of the area you're investigating is just huge, and so can you talk a little bit about your tech team? I know that that includes Stephen Johnston of A Part of Washington and, of course, Jim Frazier, your husband. So tell us about them real quick.
They're our tech team. Bill haul a camera or do whatever he wants us to, but we're definitely coming up against some real technical challenges because of the location. Lighting is a challenge. Sound is a challenge. Pretty much everything up there is a challenge because there's no electricity. So we've worked out, mostly Jim has worked out things with generators and what are those called? Inverters. And I don't know that Bill knows what he's in for tomorrow, but Bill, you're going to be hauling lots of equipment.
Oh, that's fine. When we started this project, we knew, and I explained to everybody, to Karen, and when I kind of had this idea to do these projects, I explained that, you know, at least the first one, we were going to have no budget. I didn't have, you know, investors or distribution to fund a professional crew to film this. We were just kind of doing it on our own dime, and so, you know, we're making it the best we can so that if it's marketable, we can, you know, have a crew later on. So the tech team, you know, is Jim and Steven and whoever can haul some gear around and whoever has a digital voice recorder in their hand, and which it actually makes it a lot more authentic to me. You know, when I sit on my couch or in my chair and I watch programs on TV that deal with, you know, paranormal or that kind of thing, you know, I'm kind of just like them. I'm just an average guy. I'm sitting on the couch,
mm-hmm. Right.
You know, and that's all that we are. You know, we're not here to stage anything. We're not here to necessarily reenact anything that, you know, so we're real people that are fascinated by the events and things that still happen there. So,
okay.
You know, that's kind of where we're at with the tech team. It's the, right. You know, no professional crew.
Right.
No,
nope, right.
It's us. It's all us.
Well, when all is said and done and you finished filming and finished editing the documentary and it's ready to go, what do you hope comes across? What do you hope communicates to the people who watch the documentary?
I think that my answer would probably be different than anyone else's. And that's what makes this so unique. I think that what I'd like to see come across is that there are spirits there and they're trapped. And they've been trapped since they spent 9 days in a snowstorm. They wanted to go home then. And they can't go home now for whatever reasons. And so, to me, that's my goal, is to have that feeling that I have for those spirits come across.
Okay.
And then I'd like to just tell you what Jim's goal is, and then I'll let Bill tell you his goal, but Jim's goal is to communicate the history of the location. And he's a big history buff, and he's just fascinated with everything that happened there. So Jim's goal is to kind of communicate the history and also just sort of communicate man's arrogance that we thought that we could conquer nature. And this happened just not long before the Titanic incident occurred. And so Jim's vision is just the arrogance that we have that we think that we can conquer nature, and nature always ultimately prevails.
My goal has never really changed. My goal is to, basically combine Karen and Jim's idea together. My goal is first and foremost to explain the story, but then also, because it's claimed to have a lot of paranormal activity, to, see if we can capture some of that,
Right.
And it goes hand in hand with the story. We all know what shows are on TV right now, and, we can make our own judgments whether we believe what we see or not. So what we need to do is, create something a little bit different. Not just, take our word for that, hey, we're deep in the mountains and this place is spooky. We need to explain why we think it's spooky and explain what happened to cause this spookiness. And then hopefully, capture some of it. So that's my goal, is to put out a product that's different than what's out there now, but I don't know. I guess the best answer is to combine Karen and Jim's idea together. That's my goal.
Well, okay. And I do have one other goal, and that's, I think, of paramount importance. And it is that I want people to see that you can go into a location that's haunted and that you can respect that location. So respect for the location, respect for what it is we're doing there, respect for the horrible, horrible death that these people died. I think that needs to come across as well, because I think that that can set an example for other people who go into haunted locations.
Okay.
Right. Which, right. There's so many untold things, and even just if you were to read the history and I were to read the history, or JD or Karen, we all might get a different idea of what we're picking up on. What I see when I see not just the tragedy that happened, but how hard it was immediately after that, not only to get messages through because there's no cell phones, there's no helicopters to bring us up there. There's no, they had to basically rebuild a track to get a train on there with a crane to haul debris out of there. They had to dig people out by hand. They had to have medical staff and morticians. And I mean, it's absolutely fascinating the logistics they had to endure just to clean up the area. So, in a sense, it wasn't just the avalanche, and it wasn't just the disaster. It was everything later on. It was all the court testimony and the blame. Who was to blame? And so that side of it, along with, hey, we're actually at the site now, 100 years later, and we're getting some activity that maybe can relate to the history. Is where are you going to go to get that?
Right. Where can people go to access the documentary once it's complete next year?
Well, that's a really good question. I think that we're going to have it available through Ghost Night Media, which is www.ghostnightmedia.com. And then we'll also have information on the avalancheofspirits.com website that can direct you to where to go get it.
Awesome. I can't wait to see the documentary. I know you guys have been working hard on it. So, thanks for taking the time to talk about the documentary today. And if people want to keep updated on it, go to avalancheofspirits.com and you can, there's some updates and announcements there, and look for it around March of next year.
Yeah. And also just real quick, there's a blog on avalancheofspirits.com where we post updates also in the blog. We have a Twitter, and I wish I knew what it was. Avalanche Spirits, I think. And then we have a MySpace, which is Avalanche of Spirits, and a Facebook, which is Avalanche of Spirits. So we're
easy enough.
Yeah, we're easy to remember.
Okay.
Great. Well, thanks, you guys. It was great talking to you today.
All right.
Yeah, it really was.
Thanks for coming on, Bill.
Oh, no, it was awesome. Thanks for having me on.
Yep.
Thanks, Bill. It was great talking to you.
Paranormal Underground Presents is a presentation of Paranormal Underground and Ghost Knight Media. For more information, please visit www.paranormalunderground.net or www.ghostnightmedia.com.